So welcome everyone. This is the second of the three beta lectures this week. Before we get started, I want to remind you that the last lecture is tomorrow over in Kennedy Hall at 7:30. So our speaker continuing beta series is Andy Strominger, and the title of today's seminar is The Holographic Principle in Flat Space.
Okay, so yesterday I gave a sort of physics department colloquia. Tomorrow will be a public lecture, and today I'm going to be mercilessly. I want to talk about some recent results, which I'm excited about, and so it will require some actual mathematical equations, which we didn't see much of before. But let me start by just giving less than a cartoon of what's become a rather large and active field within which this result emerged. And it's a result, just to say in the beginning, it's a result which I think makes some substantial progress on this question of what are the symmetries of nature, both in how we characterize them and what the symmetry group, though we certainly haven't solved the problem. So the starting point is that has enabled a lot of, that has provided some really powerful mathematical tools is to, we start by considering the S matrix. So here's past null infinity, here's future null infinity. And we have some particles coming in, they interact, and then we get some particles going out. So the idea is to map this to a correlation function on the circle, where for each incoming particle, you mark a point on the circle, on the sphere, and similarly for each outgoing particle. So this 3-2 S matrix would be a 5-point correlation function, where we also have to label the points in the correlation function according to whether they belong to the in region or the out region. Now, why would we want to do this? Well, one thing that's really easy to understand is that here the Lorentz group is SO31, which is SL2C, and that acts, SL2C, of course, we're just defining this to start out with is a rewriting of what's over here, and that SL2C acts as the conformal group on this two-dimensional sphere, and therefore this correlation functions will look a lot like conformalation functions in a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And even more significantly, in the last 5 years, Cacciazzo and I proved that using a subleading soft theorem, that in fact, in quantum gravity, which is our real target, there is an even bigger symmetry, and you get not only SL2C, but you get the whole infinite dimensional enhancement to the full infinite dimensional conformal group. So there's going to be a lot of similarities in the study of this object to the studies of two-dimensional conformal field theory. And just to say one other thing, what point, let's take a holomorphic coordinate z on the celestial sphere, and what is z equal to? Well, so that we'll label these by z1, z2. So zk is equal to p1k plus p2k plus I p2k over p3k minus I p P0k. And you can show that if we do a Lorentz transformation on the p's, then z goes to az plus b over cz plus d, where ad minus bc is equal to 1. And these are arbitrary complex numbers, so that's SL2c. So SL2c Lorentz transformations act very simply on the celestial sphere. Now, there are different points of view that one can take on this. One is that we're just rewriting scattering amplitudes in a different basis. In fact, Dirac proposed doing this when he was, I think it was part because of the outcry over the outrageousness of the Dirac delta function. but he didn't get very far with it. But we're getting more mileage out of it. Now you didn't get much use out of it. So you just think of this as, let's rewrite this, the S matrix, in a different basis and see what we can learn, see what properties are evident in the new basis. A more far-reaching goal is to understand flat space holography. And so the natural guess that you would make here, when you have two dual theories, usually you would have a quantum gravity theory in the bulk in this case being four-dimensional Minkowski space, and then you would have a dual theory without gravity on some smaller space, which is in some sense a boundary. And the guess here, and the symmetries are the first guide to how this can work, and so the guess would, or the hope would be that in quantum gravity, that the dual, the flat space holography, the dual is some kind of conformal field theory that lives on this celestial sphere. And I say some kind because, as we'll see, these conformal field theories that we don't understand very well, the locality properties and positivity properties and so on. So they're conformal field theories in the sense that they transform under the conformal group, but in other regards, they differ. But I'm really here going to be thinking in a bottom-up approach, and I am going to just use this rewriting. And this is so there's an outstanding problem which I posed at colloquium yesterday: is what are the fundamental symmetries of nature? And this seems to be, there are many formalisms to introduce that in. There's the Wald conserved charges, and there's S matrix relations, and there's all kinds of ways that you might try to answer that question. But this seems to be a really streamlined way to do it. Now, just one more word about this, and then I'll move on. So when we do this, over here, we always work in momentum basis eigenstates. And that is not a natural thing to do from the point of view of the celestial sphere. In fact, translations do something very odd over here. They change the conformal weight of an operator. It's better to work in some kind of conformal primary basis, the kind of thing that we're used to in conformal field theory. And the way you get conformal primaries, so you have conformal primaries of, suppose we have an endpoint amplitude, we'd call this a celestial amplitude, z1 to zn. And of course, we can have spin indices and so on, which I'm neglecting here. It's just equal to a Mellin transform of the momentum space amplitudes P1 through PN. Now, to evaluate this, We have to solve for the p's in terms of their z's. It's a couple steps, it's not too hard. And obviously they're omegas. And then do this integral and we get something which depends only on delta and z's. So we traded here, these p's are each three numbers because they all have a mass shell constraint. So we traded the three p's for the z's, which are the point on the celestial sphere where the particle exits, and its conformal weight, not its energy.
Yes.
So by going to null infinity, are you assuming that this theory only has massless particles?
Great question. So yes, when you go to null infinity, well, yes and no. I am here considering only the case of massless particles just because it's simpler. But it also works, as it must, for massive particles. And everything, I'm not making any assumptions here. You know, I'm just rewriting things in a new basis. And I can certainly rewrite massive particles in a conformal basis. And instead of a simple Mellin transform, you have a transform, you have a, to do that, instead of using a simple Mellin transform, very easy to get a massless particle into a conformal primary basis. Instead of a Mellin transform, you have an integral over the momentum space hyperboloid, sometimes called ADS, of a bulk to boundary propagator. And that gives you a massive particle in a conformal primary eigenstate. And interestingly, massive particles in conformal primary eigenstates can make it to null infinity. Sounds very counterintuitive, I know, but it's true. You know, if it's only finite energy that prevents them usually, but if you take a massive thing and accelerate it forever, it will go to null infinity, and you can write down solutions. We have written down solutions to the massive wave equation, and you compute the Klein-Gordon current, and it crosses null infinity. They're not finite energy states, neither are these. We're not working in energy eigenstates.
And then you can still use them to calculate finite energy flows.
That's matrix elements for finite energy states. You could, by Mellin transform, by convoluting back. It's a repackaging of all the, but it's a nice thing that in this repackaging of the theory, everything can be thought of as living on this celestial sphere. Okay, so now I'm gonna, yes. Z is complex, Z and Z bar. It's the coordinate on the sphere. Okay, great. So now I'm going to skip like 20 papers, and I'm just going to write down a formula and explain it and ask you to accept it and work from there. So we now think about the theory, the four-dimensional Minkowski theory, in terms of operators on a sphere. And so therefore we can talk about operator product expansions. What happens when we take, of course that's the bread and butter of conformal field theory, understanding operator product expansions. And we can talk about operator product expansions, and of course those operator product expansions have already been discussed in the quantum field theory literature. It's the collinear expansion, which people who study jet physics and so on are everybody's interested in it, I guess. And so let me write down the formula for the operator product expansion of, and I'll explain what everything means, of two positive helicity gluons. And I guess I am going to neglect the label, which in the end doesn't matter, that tells me whether it's an in or an out gluon. In our paper, we keep track of all those labels, but it's not conceptually important. Okay, delta 2, z1, z bar 1, z2, z bar 2, goes like 1 over z1, 2, minus I, f, a, b, c, Euler beta function of delta 1 minus 1, delta 2 minus 1, times O plus C, delta 1 plus delta 2 minus 1. And I remind you that the Euler beta function, which comes in all over the place, gamma of x, gamma of y, over gamma of x plus y. Okay, so this formula says that if you take two conformal primary gluons, and actually, conformal primary, let me use the word boost eigenstate. They're eigenstates, so that it's the same thing. They're actually highest weight eigenstates. They're not just any old eigenstates. Well, we call them boost eigenstates. So if I take two gluons in boost eigenstates with color A and color B, and I let them, with positive felicity, I let them get near each other, I get this, I get a third gluon, and this weight here is just dictated by the conformal invariance, which is Lorentz invariance. And then there's this coefficient. So this coefficient was first computed by Steberger and Taylor by direct transformation of the known results for collinear expansion. But later it was interestingly realized that this can be computed by no work, and that consistency with actually translation invariance, which shifts the weights of these operators, completely fixes it. So it's again showing you how certain things are more transparent in when you work in this language. Okay. Now, let me just say, because these things have spin 1, they have a left and a right conformal weight. Well, everything has a left and a right conformal weight. And it has h and h bar equal delta 1 plus 1 over 2 delta 1 minus 1 over 2. Okay, so this is a formula which I didn't derive. I just tried to tell you what it was and define all the things. There are a lot of papers on it deriving it in different ways. But before I go on, let me just ask if there are any questions about this formula. Yeah, Anna.
Is the right-hand side supposed to be the limit of the left-hand side when z's collapse on top of each other?
Yeah, right. So there are corrections here. Good. Yeah, I should have said that. There are corrections here which are suppressed by powers of z and z bar. So this is the leading term in the operator product expansion. One can also write down the whole OP block and get the whole thing. There's some exact expression where you put an equals there and you get an OP block with... Yeah, Tom.
So I know you said that it doesn't matter if it's in or out, but why is that? How do you understand that? Is it like there's two copies of a CFT, or why did it collapse to one? It seems like you would get a very different operator in the OPE depending on whether you took them together like this or like on top of each other.
Why doesn't it matter whether they're in or out? I would think of it this way. this expression, this little backward reasoning. I'm not sure from the first, but a little backward reasoning. You notice this thing has poles. And these poles are going to be related to the soft theorems. And so this whole expression is controlled by the soft theorem. This is this weird fact in gauge theory that the soft theorem, I mean, it's well known from, say, MHV amplitudes, that they're completely controlled by their soft limit. And in soft theorems, if you have like some hard charged particles coming in, you get the same answer if you have a soft photon, if you attach there or attach there. There are some subleading corrections. They're not identical for ingoing and out. If you look at the subleading corrections to these expressions, they're different. They're not the same operator, the in and the out. But the leading poles, which is what I'm interested in now, are the same for in or out. I guess I don't have a great answer to your question, but it's true.
I mean, this is versus a 2D conformal field theory. I apologize, I came in late, so you may address this already. But from what I inferred from your abstract was that you were going to use the soft graviton theorems to find some holographic mapping onto a 2D conformal field theory on the celestial sphere. And I was just wondering if, you know, it helped me as you start going through this, that I found jarring because you're two dimensions down in your holography rather than the usual just one. And so I'm wondering what's specific to this case that I should be paying attention to in advance that will explain that to me.
Well, it's not true that you're two dimensions down. So, for example, in ADS5 cross S5, you start in 10 and you go down to 4. So we don't always lose a dimension. And that's because some dimensions are compactified. And the relic of the compactified dimension here is the delta. The delta, which is at this point continuous, is, if you like, can be thought of as being related to the expansion of the modes in the extra dimension. You can think of it like this. So you can think about it like this. So we have anti-de Sitter space. So this is Minkowski space, and we can slice it into anti-de Sitter space, top and bottom. We can do a hyperbolic slicing. And then if we just concentrate on one of these anti-de Sitter slices, it would be Euclidean ADS3, we would expect a conformal field theory on the two-dimensional boundary with a Virasoro action. Then what do we do about this extra dimension? Well, we kind of Fourier transform in that dimension, and that is what leads to this delta index. This delta index rebuilds that extra dimension. Okay. So this is the formula. And now, one of the salient features of this formula is that it has poles when delta 1 goes to 1. And these poles, or delta 1 goes to, in fact, it has poles for delta 1 equals k equals 1, 0, minus 1, dot, dot, dot. You get poles. And these poles are very interesting. Let's try to understand what these poles are. So let's first define an operator, R1 of, let's first talk about the pole when delta 1 goes to 1. And the poles are all different in an interesting way. And these poles are going to be related in a very simple and direct way to the infinite tower of soft theorems. The first one is going to be the standard soft gluon theorem, tree-level soft gluon theorem, and then the next one is going to be the subleading one, and then the new ones are ones that people have sort of mumbled about but not said anything very precise about, but we'll now be able to get a very precise formalism and moreover get the algebra of the whole tower. So we define an operator R1A of Z. Maybe I want to put the one, I put it there now. R1A of Z is defined as the limit as delta goes to 1 of delta minus 1 O plus A delta of Z and Z bar. So first of all, why isn't this operator just zero? We're multiplying by zero. The O's were supposed to be nice operators. We're multiplying by zero. Why would we be interested in such a thing? Well, the point is that those O's have poles in their operator product expansions. And therefore, when we multiply by precisely this amount, this operator that sits at the pole will have finite OPE coefficients. And moreover, notice that its weight is 1, 0. So we expect it to be a current. And indeed, that is one of the beautiful things that happens when you go to the celestial sphere, that soft theorems are generated by currents, holomorphic currents like this. In general, they're Katz-Moody currents. And we're going to see in this talk that, in fact, they're a whole tower of W infinity currents. And all the consequences of soft theorems are equivalent to the consequences that we're used to of a Katz-Moody symmetry on a two-dimensional sphere. Yes. Yes,
that delta minus 1 should be in parentheses, right?
Yes.
And in the OPE expansion that you wrote above, it only depends on Z, not Z bar. Is that intentional?
It's just true that's the leading term. We're doing the leading pole as Z1 goes to as Z1 and Z2. Very importantly, we treat Z and Z bar independently. And that is something which has become ubiquitous. So ubiquitous, it's usually not even stated in the so-called amplitudes program. And it amounts to going to 2, 2 signature. So effectively, we're going to be working in 2, 2 signature. And we're much more used to working in Euclidean signature than 2, 2 signature. But there are very definite rules. I think Mason and Skinner wrote a very precise paper about this 20 years ago, about how you take amplitudes in 2, 2 and analytically continue them back to 3, 1. In fact, in many ways, I think it's nicer than going from Euclidean space because in 2, 2, you can stay on shell.
Andy, that might be the answer to the question I was asking earlier. That maybe they look different when you come back to 3, 1.
Okay, there is a very beautiful answer which I can't resist giving since you asked it. When you go to 2, 2. The boundary, so the scry becomes, there's only one scry. There's only one null infinity, there aren't two, and it's a torus, not a sphere. And there are two patches, it's a Lorentzian torus, and there are two patches. And when you analytically continue back to 3, 1, one of them goes to the past celestial sphere and the other one goes to the future celestial sphere. So it's actually a much nicer way to, there's a lot of calculational techniques, advantages that have been exploited in the amplitudes community by treating spinner, you know, they go to the spinner helicity formalism and I guess this goes back to Penrose. Well, when you analytically continue, when you analytically continue and conformally compactify, that's what happens. I can't say it in 2 seconds, but that's what happens. So the operators on the torus corresponding to in and out states live at different points. Okay. So now if we take the OP of this operator, RA1 of Z, with any, let me call this a soft, or I should really say conformally soft, but it's too much of a mouthful, O plus B of delta of Z and Z bar, we get minus I Z1, Z1, 2, 2 bar, get minus I FABC, Z1, 2, O plus C of Z2, Z bar 2, which you will recognize is a standard, so this is any operator on the sphere, let me call it a hard operator in a conformal basis, and you'll recognize this as a standard OPE relation for a non-abelian Katz-Moody symmetry in a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And so if we start taking correlation functions, this is a current, looking at correlation functions, we can look at contours and we can integrate these currents around these contours and we can get identities by deforming the contours around the two sides of the sphere. And that is an elegant reformulation of all the identities on scattering amplitudes that we get when we study, when we study space-time scattering amplitudes. Okay, but now there are other poles. What happens when, what do we do?
Why did it become singular when delta went to 1? Like, if you didn't put that 1 minus delta factor in there, you would have gotten something more singular.
Yes. Well, it's the conformal. If I had been working in energy space, I would have gotten a pole in W. That's the famous soft pole in the soft theorems. If you insert a soft photon in a S matrix element, you get a pole as its energy goes to zero. That pole becomes a pole in delta when you go to the conformal basis. Okay, now, what about delta 1 goes to 0? Well, when delta 1 goes to 0, we get what we want to define is the limit. When delta goes to 0, there's not one current, but two currents. And we write it as delta. So, we take the limit as delta goes to zero of delta OA plus delta, and we expand that as the square root of Z bar times RA minus a half Z plus 1 over square root of Z bar RA plus a half, wait, what did I do here? Of Z, RA plus a half of Z. And so we get a doublet of currents here, and these are closed under the action of SL2R bar. And notice now that H and H bar become a half minus a half. So the H bar weight here is becoming negative. And that is the kind of thing that one usually wouldn't consider in ordinary conformal field theory, negative conformal weights. But when you have negative conformal weights, you have nice finite dimensional representations, and a negative conformal weight minus a half, the SL2R bar, you have an operator which is in a doublet. So you get a doublet of subleading soft gluon currents. And this was known, that there were two, I think was already known by Francis Lowe in some sense in the 50s. Mina Himwich and I made it very clear that there were two separate currents with Ward identities, but we didn't understand what their relationship was to another. And now we've understood it all in a more systematic way, that these are just in SL2R bar doublets. And if you look now, these RA of Zs, both of them, have OPEs with the Os, which we could easily write down. And those OPEs are equivalent to the subleading soft gluon current, or if we were doing QED, the subleading soft photon current. So more generally, there's a whole tower. Now, the fact that there's a whole infinite, so we see that we can get poles at any negative n. We can get infinite poles at any negative n. And the fact that there are infinite tower of soft theorems, I think it's kind of in Penrose and Newman's early stuff, although they didn't quite understand what to do with it. But more explicitly, it was in recent things by Hamada and Xu and Guevara and Lin and Zhang. People have been writing it, but when you write it in energy space, it's very confusing. And in fact, in energy space, there are, nobody knows how to define the soft S matrix in the usual translation basis, because the double soft limits in energy space, when you have more than one thing, it doesn't commute. So we don't know what here. In the conformally soft limits, there is an unambiguous S matrix, including the boundaries where the weights go to integer values. So now we consider a whole tower generalizing these things as the limit epsilon goes to zero of O plus comma A of K plus epsilon ZZ bar, which we write as the sum from n equals k minus 1 over 2 to n equals 1 minus k over 2. Remember that k is, so n is always 0 or positive because k is getting negative, of r a k comma n of z, z bar, to the n plus k over 2. All right, so these are all SL2R multiplets, just keeping the z dependence straight. These are all SL2R multiplets of higher and higher but finite size as k grows. They go like 2k plus 1, I guess. And minus 2k plus, Something like that, okay. So these are all soft currents, and they will all have finite OPEs, and so we get an infinite tower of these things. And these are, you know, what I was talking about in my talk yesterday, these all generate, this whole tower generate their symmetries. They're part of the symmetries of nature that I was talking about yesterday. They have observable memory, like, you know, there's predictions that come from them. Now, one thing, let's see. Okay, but what's even better is I've got all these things, and now I can compute their OPE. And I can find the algebra of this group of all the symmetries.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Yeah.
What about the poles of delta 2? Is there something special with delta 1? I mean, if I remember correctly, the form of the function B was like a product of gamma functions over...
Well, I mean, I was writing O plus A delta 1, O plus B delta 2, 1 over Z1, 2. Beta of delta 1 minus 1, delta 2 minus 2, 1, and then, oh, so it's symmetric in 1 and 2, right? O delta 1 plus delta 2 minus 1. And what I'm doing right now is I'm making both of them go to negative integers. And so then we're going to see the algebra of them. And what you find is that the commutator RKAM, RL, BM is equal to minus IF, and this is a slightly long formula, but I promise it's the last long one I'll write, 1 minus K over 2 plus 1 minus L over 2 plus N plus M. I'm just doing this so you'll be appreciative when I write a much simpler formula later, factorial, 1 minus L over 2 minus M, actually plus M factorial, and then times the whole thing with N goes to minus N, M goes to minus M, times R C K plus L minus 1 C, N plus M. And you can check that this obeys the Jacobi identity. And this commutator is defined by A commutator B with Z is equal to the contour integral 1 over 2 pi I, A of Z, B of W, dz. So this is a two-dimensional commutator. It's not a four-dimensional commutator. I never looked at things at earlier or later times. This is, if you want, you can think of this as a commutator in the dual one-dimensional Hilbert space on a circle of the two-dimensional field theory. So we're taking, you could to evaluate this explicitly, you would take S matrix element, and you would evaluate like two points like this, and then you would consider what happens if you move one point around the other point. You're not putting some operators later in time and some earlier in time. And this result was obtained in collaboration with Alfredo Guevara, Mina Himwich, and Monica Pate. Okay, I'm going to move on to gravity, which I'm going to be much faster with. But
So you started with what I thought were local operators, but maybe they weren't local operators because in your OPE is a non-local operator. Where does this operator R live? Is it integrated over scribe?
Wait, why do you think they're non-local?
Well, they're acting like conserved charges. They're not acting like conserved currents. They're not functions. The R's are not functions of Z, are they?
Yes.
Oh, they are functions of Z.
Sorry.
This looks like the algebra of charges, but it's... Is it the same Z?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Sorry. It's RR of Z. So what you do is we have two holomorphic operators. It's this thing, right? Well, here's the definition.
Okay, I see. So they're currents.
They're currents.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So let me now turn to gravity. So so we worked out just using the symmetry, all the leading singular terms in the OPE for gravity. Gravitons and gluons of any helicity, just using the symmetries. Anna and Monica and LSUN and I did this for their leading OPEs. Yes.
Sorry, I didn't mention this, but the unitarity of the scattering matrix. Did you mention what constraints that puts on the CFT?
So. I mean, we're rewriting a unitary theory. So the four-dimensional S matrix is, if it's unitary in one set of variables, it's unitary in another set of variables. It's a very interesting question. There's lots of interesting questions like that. What unitarity of the four-dimensional S matrix means for the two-dimensional theory. I don't know the answer. Actually, there was a paper by He Huang and Uqin Huang and some amplitudes people who were addressing this in part and understanding the unitary constraints, translating the unitary constraints on the, the EFT hedron into constraints on the things in the celestial amplitudes. But I think there are things to say there. There isn't like some really, at this point, some sharp, simple. There's lots of other interesting questions like. What does crossing symmetry in 4D mean in 2D? And even more interesting is what does crossing symmetry in 2D mean for the 4D theory? Because the 2D crossing symmetry looks very strange from the point of view of the 4D theory. It looks like a very, very powerful constraint. So a lot of questions like that that haven't been answered. But, I mean, there isn't any question here about what the theory is. So they must have answers somehow. But how exactly, what are the right tools to get at them? So in gravity, well, there's a similar formula. We have gravitons. So we have delta 1, z1, z bar 1, with the second graviton, again, plus helicity. And let me say, because I'm not sure I mentioned it before, I am in this talk only considering plus helicities. It's not that plus helicities are more interesting than mixed helicities with plus and minus. In fact, the mixed helicity case with plus and minus is probably more interesting. It's also much harder, and we haven't figured out how to make sense of it. The operator product expansion in the plus helicity sector closes, so we're free to consider this as a separate subset, but we should be fully aware that we're far from the end of the story, even when we fully understand this separate subset. I think it might be a little bit like when you try to make a consistent conformal field theory. You start with the sort of the conformal blocks or the Virasoro blocks of primaries of different weights, and they're easy and simple to describe and have lots of properties. And then when you try to glue them in together into a left movers and right movers and with a modular invariant partition function, that's the really hard problem in conformal field theory. So maybe what we're doing here is solving the easy problem. This goes like, again, the ubiquitous Euler beta function. The reason these beta functions appear all over the place is that the OPE, they're to ensure translation invariance. These have to do something special when you shift the weights by integers. Beta functions have nice properties, recursion relations under integer shifts that make it all work out. Now there's a z bar 1-2 over z 1-2. This is the leading singularity in z 1-2. G plus delta 1 plus delta 2. That's the leading OPE. And now again, we do an expansion where we write limit as epsilon goes to 0 of epsilon times g plus epsilon plus k, where now k equals 2, 1. Before we started at 1, but now we're starting at 2. And this is equal to some sum from n equals k minus 2 over 2 to 2 minus k over k, hnk of z over z bar to the n plus k minus 2 over 2. And this is, these h's now are currents. They're in multiplets, higher and higher and bigger multiplets. And they're exactly the multiplets, they're the exact analogs of the R's I was talking about before. It's just all the numbers are a little bit different in gravity. Now, instead of writing out the commutators of these H's, I'm going to redefine something new. WNP is equal to gamma of P minus N, gamma of P plus N, hn minus 2p plus 4. So I get some complicated commutators for the h's, but now I'm going to make this field redefinition. And this field redefinition, in terms of the z bar dependence, is non-local, because I'm mixing up the modes. And it's actually related to something that's very much studied in conformal field theory called the light transform. And one finds that the W's, after doing this, that the operator algebra is WNP, WNQ is equal to MQ minus 1 minus NP minus 1. WM plus N, P plus Q, minus 2, where all these W's depend on Z's. So this is a Ketz-Moody algebra. The Ketz-Moody algebra is called W1 plus infinity. And W1 plus infinity is a famous group in mathematical physics. I'll talk about where it's appeared, but let me mention that M is also restricted in its range because N was restricted in its range here. And so so this is called the Ketz-Moody group is the wedge algebra of W1 plus infinity. Now, exactly this group has appeared many times in mathematical physics. Just to mention a few, it appeared, the first time that I know it appeared is Penrose used this in his construction of the general self-dual field configuration in twister space or in 2, 2 signature. And basically, they were all generated, all the different solutions were generated by the WNs. Klebanoff and Polyakov found the generators of this as the discrete states of C equals 1 string theory. A deformation of this algebra, there's an interesting quantum deformation of this algebra, which I think should have some role to play in things, but I don't know what, describes the algebra of a free field in two dimensions or a free fermion in two dimensions. There's something called W gravity that Chris Pope and Shun and others worked out. It appeared in the matrix theory and the construction of the large N limit, not BFSS, but before that, the Hoppe and the supergravity people started out a large N limit of SU infinity, and they got W infinity out of that. Without the Zs, this is the algebra of area-preserving diffeomorphisms. So it's a very important infinite-dimensional higher-spin algebra in two dimensions. It's probably the only one with such a simple closed expression. So four good things have happened all at once here that made me anyway happy about these developments. The first thing is that we've known for a long time that there had to be more soft theorems, because we knew that Lowe's subleading soft theorem doesn't commute with itself and gives you more symmetries. And so there had to be some tower that were higher and higher in something. But there was no way to organize. It got very messy. Nobody could guess what the next thing is. There was no way to organize them. Finally, we organized them in terms of these H's, but they had these insane, complicated-looking commutators that obeyed the Jacobi identities, but still, why should it be so complicated? Then we did, I did this field redefinition, and I found the whole thing reduced to probably the most studied, nicest infinite dimensional algebra of this type. So that seemed like a good thing. The other interesting thing is that somehow everybody who's bothered by the negative weights, somehow in this field redefinitions, if we classify it according to WN representation, all the weights are positive. So we lost this negative weight business. Now, this is not all the operators in the theory. Maybe the negative weights will come back. But somehow the negative weights has disappeared. Secondly, there's been a number of papers out of the twister community at Oxford. They knew this formula, they think. We've been spending months trying to reconcile our notations. But they knew this formula. Maybe even Penrose knew this formula. They knew about light transforms. And they knew that it was a good idea to work in this funny basis. And they certainly knew that there was a W infinity hanging around. And moreover, some of the amplitudes that one could computes in the celestial amplitude formula, we don't know what basis of operators to use. But Sharma recently shown in the basis of operators that a twister theorist would naturally use, all the singularities go away, like the delta function on the equator. I don't know, whoever's followed this program knows that there are various kind of singularities that we don't quite know how to deal with. So that seems a good thing. But perhaps the most exciting thing is all is that this W infinity is a big and powerful group. It's in the past, it's always arised in integrable models. The twister people loved it, but I don't ever think they had any idea that it would persist into the real world. And we didn't use anything here except soft theorems that apply to the real world. So we're learning that this powerful infinite dimensional group, which was, we thought, relegated to the domain of really fun integrable models in two dimensions, in fact, is the symmetry group of any theory, is part of the symmetry group, I've only done the positive velocity part, is part of the symmetry group in the limit. There's two limits that we've taken here. We've ignored the cosmological constant, and also, I'm going to say a minute something about quantum corrections in a moment. It exists as a subset of the symmetry group of nature. There should be experiments associated with it, memory type experiments. And it exists as a symmetry of a subgroup of the symmetry of nature. And we've also ignored here the effect of quantum corrections. Now, let me just say a few more things, and then I'll come back. So it's in the classical limit. One is that I can now do a similar transformation on the gauge fields. Sm gamma is equal to gamma q minus m, gamma q plus m, times my r's, r a q, r a, what is it? It's r a 3 minus 2 q, comma m. And then the SMs, instead of that horrible algebra I wrote on the previous board, just obey SMA, SNB equals minus I FABC, SC M plus N, and then there's weights here, QP. And then this becomes q plus p minus 1, I think. Yeah, minus 1. So they form a very, very simple algebra. And moreover, the W's, all the soft gluon currents are in one irreducible representation of the W algebra. So that is WMQ. Let me just get all the numbers exactly right. WMP, WMP, where'd it go? SQAN is equal to MQ minus 1 minus n p minus 1 s p plus q minus 2 comma a m plus n. So the soft gluon operators or soft photon operators are all in an irreducible representation of this W, W1 plus infinity. Now, important corrections are, important question is what kind of corrections are there? Just some, and there are several papers on this. It's very hard to correct a soft theorem. And some of them, the leading soft theorems, are known to have no corrections to all orders in the loop expansion. They can't be correction. The subleading ones are a little more vulnerable. They can sort of have anomalies, or they can, there's a few, they all, each have a short list of higher dimension operators that can correct them, which are nicely discussed in a paper by Henrietta Elvang. Other people discuss it too, but that, I like to look at that one. There's a short list of higher dimension operators. We have to think about those corrections. And we were also very interested in quantum corrections. What do quantum corrections do? So what Elvang looked at is sort of in a Wilsonian effective theory, what are the, which operators will correct this algebra? But in Wilsonian effective theory, you also have to integrate over loops of massive particles, and those could somehow correct those algebras. And we checked it in the one place where we could, and that is the Yang-Mills theory and gravity have all plus amplitudes. So MHV amplitudes are sort of mostly pluses and two minuses. But at the one loop level, you get all plus amplitudes. And those all plus amplitudes, even in gravity, are ultraviolet finite. They take a very specific and very complicated form, much more complicated than the MHV amplitudes. We haven't put the paper out, but we've shown, and it actually surprised me, that the W algebra is completely intact. It's not deformed. It's not, doesn't have an anomaly. It's exact even at the level of the all plus corrections. So kind of expecting it was going to get deformed, but haven't seen where that comes from yet. So we don't quite know what's going to happen next, but we think it should be interesting. So maybe I'll stop there.
Questions.
Yeah, I have two questions. The first question is, so you're saying there is no central expansion if you consider a quantum correction?
I hesitate to say that because I wanted there to, I was anticipating a central extension at the loop level, but there's more, there's more currents in this story. I told you, these are just the soft currents. They also have partners which are currents, which you could think of as the Goldstone currents, right? So these are symmetries. Like in a two-dimensional conformal field theory, even without a level. Think about a two-dimensional conformal for the U1 current algebra, no level, but charged fields. And the charged fields are, you could bosonize the charge and you can make a current out of it. So these theories tend to have off-diagonal levels. They have a matrix of levels with other currents. So we've understood something about how that happens in the U1 case, not so much in gravity or the non-abelian case. Yeah, and these things are the, you know, it's the things that source the soft currents, so the Wilson lines, and you know, some work has been done representing these things as how you compute their correlators. We understand how to compute. There's a current, there's a soft algebra that succinctly characterizes. There's a lot of discussion about the factorization of the S matrix into a hard and a soft part. And that's more, at least in my mind, it's more elegantly done when you work in a conformal basis and you factorize into the conformally soft and the conformally hard part. And then you find a soft current algebra that generates the soft S matrix. And that includes not only these soft modes, but Goldstone modes, the Goldstone currents, the things that make Wilson lines. The correlations of the soft Goldstone modes are the correlations of the Wilson lines, which have, of course, been studied quite a bit in quantum field theory, and we know about them. And then the levels in these things become the cusp anomalous dimensions, which can be thought of as one loop things. So in some sense, there's levels arising at one loop, but in a different object. And it's in the matrix of currents. And we haven't studied yet the whole matrix at this level. We're actually starting to do that.
I see. Another quick question is, how can I see this is related to like super translation,
super rotation? How can you see that it's
Are they related to the like super translations?
Yeah. So the current, let me just talk about the H's. So H, let's see, H, one, H with delta equals one plus of Z, it's actually a doublet because it has weight 3/2 minus 1/2. So we should write it as H, let me just tell it to you this way. We can write that as H plus or minus 1/2. Those are the two indices, the doublet in the SL2R representation of Z. And then that's in a multiplet, H minus 1/2 is equal to D bar, the limit as delta goes to 1 of D bar, which takes a descendant, takes you from L1 to L minus 1, D bar of G of 1 of Z bar. And this is the thing, this is exactly the thing that I was calling, 5 or 10 years ago, the super translation current. So, and this is the thing whose Ward identities I proved were equivalent to Weinberg's soft graviton theorem and generated, this is the field that that I showed was equivalent both to the leading soft theorem in sort of one of the first papers I wrote on this subject. So all these fields are related in a very, very concrete way that is not very long. The formulas are not very long. One thing that has been a simplification here is that in the earlier work, one was talking just about soft currents and analyzing things according to powers of the energy, omega. And it's almost equivalent, but it's conceptually much clearer to talk about conformally soft currents. Yeah. Yeah.
So in ordinary holography, we have like a strong weak duality, the bulk gravitational coupling is 1/Yang-Mills. Is there something like that here?
I wouldn't, Yeah, I think that, you know, gravity in the bulk is at any n is dual, or any G Yang Mills is dual to, or any G string is dual to Yang Mills theory on the boundary at any n and any G Yang Mills. Well, they're related in some way. But you don't have to be in the large n limit for the duality to hold. So Yang-Mills theory has two, if you like, Yang-Mills theory has two classical limits. One is where G Yang-Mills becomes strong, small, and quantum corrections are suppressed. And one is when n becomes large and there's factorization of correlation functions of operators, and there's a completely different classical limit. And we would identify that with the classical limit of gravity in the bulk. Now, we might not be so lucky in constructing a duality to have such a simple situation. You know, for example, in M theory, in M theory in 11 dimensions, where there's no parameter, there's no dimensionless parameter. There can't really be two descriptions. I suppose we can think about expanding it, scattering amplitudes and momenta over the Planck mass. So we're speaking in very general terms here about any theory of quantum gravity and any theory with a gauge sector. And so there isn't another parameter that we've put into the discussion, but I think if one were to construct an actual useful, you know, sort of top-down example of this, you know, starting from string theory or something, starting out with saying, here we construct the celestial CFT, here's an intrinsic definition, we would likely need such a parameter to do it.
Okay, we should probably wrap up. Let's thank Andy again.